Coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm.
Hello, everybody. Hope you're all doing well. Hope you've all had a great week. Welcome to episode 235, our whole new show look. It's been a long time since we launched Curious Realm, and since then we've had like a rebranding of some things. It was hard for me to get rid of the moving Scarfield that has been there since the days of the original Dudes and Beer live streams when we started doing it. We didn't start doing video until COVID, actually. Once the lockdown happened, we began doing video every week because I had the time to produce it. Had the time to do it right. It was always one of those, if I was to do video from the studio back in the day of Dudes and Beer, it was like three of us sitting around a table, four of us sitting around a table. So it's like, what am I going to do? Like put a 360 cam and let people tune in with VR goggles and they can like look around the table while we drink beer and talk about whatever. But once we started doing it, it became something that I really kind of got into. It became the fact of I can't imagine being an audio-only show anymore, especially for the information that we share on screen, the data that we put up on screen, the graphs, the documents, all kinds of things. It really is a supplement to the show that goes on, so... it was time for a rebrand, time for a redesign of the live show. If you like what we did, let us know. If you don't like what we did, especially, let us know. As always, let us know if you don't like what we're putting out there. But our show tonight, I am more than excited for. Our good friend Mike Turber will be joining us in the second segment as our pre-record guest, talking about the second tranche of documents that have been released by the Department of War, the videos, most of which, oddly enough, out of like the nine that were released, I want to say like five or six of them were in the new documentary Sleeping Dog that Jeremy Corbell put out before the videos were released and declassified. So we get into that a little bit. Our guest in the first part, I'm very happy to bring them back. Both of them are good friends of the show. They've been on numerous times. The first guest is our good friend King Gerhard. He is the author of The Essential Guide to Bigfoot, as well as so many other books that you can find over at kinggerhard.com/store. That's The Essential Guide to Mothman, Essential Guide to Loch Ness Monsters, Big Bird, so many other things. And our guest, in addition to him, is the amazing Anne Celine. Her new book, Signals from the Elephant Cage, which I wrote the foreword to, is now out and available on Amazon. Stop on by. You can check that out. You can pick that up over at anceline.com/store. We are talking about the topic of para-investigation. And when I say para-investigation, folks, it's everything paranormal. And Ken, pardon me. You know I am very, very staunch on the fact of cryptozoology is different than paranormal, but sadly and horribly, it's all wrapped up in what is not normal. So I loathe using the term paranormal with cryptozoology because I truly see cryptozoology as an on-ramp to biology in so many ways.
Well, thank you for having us on once again, Christopher. It's always good to see you, brother.
Always, man.
So like in zoology, you have lumpers and splitters in terms of, how people classify animals. You have a taxonomic system for classifying animals, and there are some zoologists that'll say, well, a puma, a mountain lion is a mountain lion. And then there, the splitters will say, well, there's actually 18 subspecies of mountain lions, So, I think that's part of it. It's just, some of us are prone to kind of lump a lot of these, mysteries together because they all kind of strike a similar chord in terms of, our fascination with them. But John Tenney, who I respect as a great paranormal investigator, he would often argue with me and say, look, man, it's all cryptozoology is paranormal. It's not normal. That's literally the definition of paranormal is, it's not a normal. So, there is an argument to be made there, I guess. And then, of course, we were always talking about the three of us in different conversations about, patternicity and how people are just, wanting to connect things sometimes. And so, for whatever reason and convenience or just the whim of the moment, but people that are prone to patternicity often will try to find meaningful connections between, ghost hunting and UFOs and cryptozoology, and it kind of all gets embedded together. So, but I appreciate what you said. I feel like I'm kind of the last of my kind in many ways, or one of the last. That is, the founders of my field, cryptozoology, were actual zoologists, and they followed a pretty scientific methodology. And in the 80s, I think we had a heyday when we had the International Society of Cryptozoologists, which was, Bernard Heuvelmans president and Roy Mackel vice president, and you had all these guys like Grover Krantz. It was all scientists, and they were all kind of mavericks, because they were willing to accept the ideas that there were undiscovered animals and things. But of course, through the years, culturally, things have kind of changed in terms of how cryptozoology is viewed. And of course, the term cryptid is now often used to describe things like skinwalkers and aliens and, black-eyed kids and things that the founding fathers would never accept as, cryptozoology. Those seem to be completely different types of phenomenon.
And that brings up a huge point of the fact of, I guess you would talk about technically the taxonomy of these phenomena and the fact of, when you're talking Rake, pale walkers, even Wendigo, stuff like that. Like, those traditionally are not cryptozoologic creatures in that kind of way.
To me, they're not. No. Like I said, I'm kind of a purist in terms of cryptozoology, but someone else may enter the field, and there are people now in the field who kind of fall more of like the what I describe as the Keelian kind of philosophy, which is based on John Keel. He was the first guy. I mean, you could go to Charles Fort probably before that. And then we all know that Charles Fort in the early 1900s was trying to find these connections between all these different things. But John Keel, based on my research, is the first researcher that tried to connect, for example, Bigfoot to UFOs. He did that in his book, Strange Creatures from Time and Space, which was published in 1970. And then throughout the early 70s, there were other researchers like Jerome Clark and others that were basically trying to, they were writing articles in UFO Review, Flying Saucer Review, and some of those popular UFO mags in the 70s would often feature Bigfoot on the cover and things like that. So those are the types of ways where you can see kind of a paradigm shift, and where people, the newer generations of researchers kind of are influenced by that. And as they come up, they say, oh, Bigfoot, maybe Bigfoot is from a UFO or interdimensional or whatever. And so I think that's part of how we find ourselves where we are at this point.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that kind of bounces us right over to Anne and Anne's world, which is the world of paranormal, not just paranormal research, but parapsychology in its truest sense. The idea of how does psychology play into these things? How do the way that humans observe things to begin with, and the tropes that we have, not just historically in our mind, play into them, but the tropes that are even going on in modern society. One of the big things that we talk about regularly with our mutual friend Ryan Edwards is the way that numerous of the, like a Wendigo is a prime example. The concept of that has drastically changed over the last 10 years since creepypasta and all that kind of stuff came onto the scene, as opposed to the traditional stories of Wendigo and what the appearance was, which was once again much more paranormal than cryptozoological in that kind of way. So it's interesting to see how the tropes of society are playing in on these and moving them in that kind of way.
Yeah, no, it's interesting because, I mean, I think that at least right now in my current knowledge and belief system, humans love to be afraid. We get that adrenaline rush. That's why we have horror movies. That's why we have thrill rides. It's, you know, all of that kind of stuff.
Yep.
And putting that aside, though, I think that we also have things epigenetically in our history that, I mean, because if you went back, do you remember how far back it was, that book that of yours where, I mean, we wouldn't even recognize our, you know,
our current English language?
No, the extinction book.
Oh, gosh. Extinct animals.
Yeah, like it wasn't long ago that if we could time travel, then we wouldn't even recognize a lot of the plant. There's plants, animals, and everything, and just how we functioned there, you know. And then when we got into the, you know, the tribes, the villages, and it became us, and then everything out there was to be feared, and so all these things get passed down. So we're kind of connecting to two different things, I think, you know, epigenetically, the monsters of our past and also parts of ourselves, but also just that thrill and that rush of adrenaline and everything. And so, of course, we're going to turn Sasquatch into a monster. You know, of course, we're going to make something look a little scarier as time goes on, or, you know, create the creepy pastas because what's some, you know, a favorite pastime around a campfire?
Yeah.
Telling scary stories.
Yeah, exactly. So, well,
and
I got another one. I saw an article on the news this morning that a very recent survey of what people want to see at the movies, and it was horror.
Yeah.
That was like the number one that people want to be scared. So I was just
you're good.
It's true.
Well,
it's still talking scary stories.
Yeah.
Not just that. It's also the fact of we want something familiar. We want something that leans on our culture, on our history, all kinds of things. And we've talked about that before, Ken, whenever I've had you on, and we've discussed topics like Dog Man and things like that, where when you get into the locations where these sightings of things like that are, it's very interesting to see that they have cultural ties to stories like that, you know, be they Germanic or French, Greek cultures, things like that, where lycanthropy, that kind of stuff was regularly talked about in their histories, that kind of thing. So the idea of that being a part of the identification of something and something that we just tend to automatically go to almost as a comfort blanket, so to speak.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But I think, you know, as we talk about fear and being afraid, I mean, there's that old saying about, or was it Lovecraft that was talking about, you know, there's nothing scarier than the unknown, you know, the true unknown. If we don't have the answers, if we don't understand. And that's kind of what the common thread that runs through all of these mysteries is, that there's that element of fear because we don't understand exactly what any of these phenomena represent.
But also, to your point as well, we know, we've created this knowledge around like the werewolf. We know how the werewolf functions. We know how, well, I mean, we don't know, but that's, we've created a schema around it, like an association. And then, you know, same with Bigfoot. I mean, but you have the people that are in the different camps that are like, I'm happy in this belief system with Sasquatch. This is what feels known and right, which then kind of goes into, of course, when we offer up different opinions, and as we are researchers and stuff, if we contest a belief system,
challenge it,
it can really create a crumbling of a person, which is really, really hard. And I think that's one of the, you know, talking about one of the things that's so hard with investigations and in our field, it's offering up new insights without, you know, having that, creating that, I guess it would be dissonance, right? Because you may, you know, so.
Well, offering insights without creating a confrontational atmosphere.
Yeah.
that's the most HR way to say it. quite literally. Because, and I mean, like, I had it happen. I was just telling, and Godspeed to all you travelers on your way back from contact in the desert right now. That is a hardcore show. Like, it ends Monday night. Like, crazy stuff. So, like, there are people they have sessions all the way through Monday. It's crazy.
Wow.
And I was just speaking with one of my friends from Contact in the Desert this morning, talking with her, and I was sharing a story about my Lyft driver. EDC, Electric Daisy Carnival, was going on during my show in Vegas. So it took a long time to get from the airport to the dispensary to my hotel. So I had about 40 minutes, and I'm talking with this Lyft driver the whole time, and we immediately just... He brings up the, have you seen the disclosure files? This was when the first batch of files had just come out. And I was like, oh, absolutely. And we got into it. And then we got into the death of David Wilcock and his suicide. And where that came from and where that sourced from. And that's when he was confronted, because he began the conversation of cosmic disclosure and Corey Good and all kinds of things. And when I revealed to him that no, Corey Good said that all of that was fiction, that he wrote it, that it's his concept, that he's busy suing Gaia Network for continuing the show without him, and that anybody else who said that they had these experiences was delusional, I could literally see his columns of understanding of what he thought to be real begin to crack and crumble, like in front of my eyes, where like he never knew this information. And suddenly he was confronted with something that like he's spent the last decade deep diving into these concepts and into these people and following every rabbit hole that they dig, only to find out that it's all based on fiction. You know, and that's rough. And yeah, that's something as investigators that we have to be careful of. You know, we have to be careful how we approach these conversations with experiencers. And at the same time, we have to be open minded, even as scientists, to the fact of the extraordinary, to the fact of the strange and weird and unexplained. You know, it's a weird didactic that we kind of have to live in and court,
right? That kind of no, way. It definitely is, and it's one of those things where this is a perfect example of why, you know, we have to be so careful, and why we really need to be, you know, I think have more heart and intelligence in regards to like making sure that we know that our actions, people really look to us.
Yeah.
You know, for these things. And then a whole world will be created in somebody's life based on things that we do. And I don't think that, you know, or that we present or whatever. And I wish that more people really took that to heart. So,
yeah. Now, when it comes especially to that science versus belief point. And I don't like, I bring it up all the time in my presentations that I give. I have a whole slide of a scientist fighting somebody, like in a boxing ring. But quite literally, it is the fact of, and so many people on both sides, both the side of science and the side of woo, do not like hearing from the other at all.
Yeah.
Like I know a good three or four researchers here in Texas who will utterly and immediately dismiss anything science says. Like the first thing out the gate is they're lying. Straight out. And it's hard to get through that facade. It's hard to find some kind of common ground to approach things with at that point, you know, because it is one of those you've decided not to listen to new data.
Right. Well, and it also shows kind of where their mental status is, and it could be an indicator of some unhealed trauma or, sure, you know, different things. And again, how do we approach that? I wish that there was like a course, like when we get into these things and we want to be speakers and we want to, you know, I know that there's not, and that's wishful thinking, but, you know, I mean, like I recently learned, so if I want to conduct certain types of, they were like surveys, right?
Mm-hmm. It was a survey. Yeah. Gathering data.
Right. So when I'm in college and I get to that point where I can then start doing surveys, it has to be vetted in a way that it protects the general public, because there are things that you can ask people that will re-traumatize them.
Yep.
And they, I mean, it's a whole legal thing. And this is like, that's just a questionnaire.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I mean, what are, you know?
It is the fact of you have to phrase things very carefully. No different than any therapist or something like that. There's a reason why those kind of atmospheres are built around that kind of question forming, you know, mm-hmm. and even to the point of science, like scientifically, that's why most things, scientific surveys, things like that, are written dispassionately. The purpose is to remove that from it as much as possible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so.
Yeah, well, I mean, one of the big themes this past weekend in Kentucky, and we talked about it when I got back, is, you know, you can't argue against beliefs.
No.
I mean, there's no argument there. Nope. Between belief and science. So, you know, the idea of trying to convert someone or open someone's mind, I mean, I guess that sounds kind of negative now I'm hearing myself say it out loud, but, you know, if we look at the history, I mean, centuries ago, if there was someone that took a kind of a scientific attitude, the stars are not gods floating around up there.
Yeah.
Then you're a heretic, right? At that point, you know, it's basically a religion and, you know, in the West, it was, of course, the Roman Catholic Church for centuries, or, you know, yep, whatever religion around the world. And then, you know, in at the end of the 18th century, beginning of the 19th century, when you started to have like the birth of paleontology, and, you know, people were beginning to accept that, yes, these bones being found in the ground were not gods or giants from a past civilization. They were animals that lived in the past or whatever. And then, of course, Darwinism and all that kind of stuff. And even at that time in the mid 19th century,
yep,
there was a lot of soul searching that went on with academics and scientists who were still maybe from a Christian or Catholic background and still kind of were struggling with that, you know, science versus spirituality or religion.
Absolutely.
And how those could coexist. Right. So I think, as science has kind of, you know, certainly gotten a much more of a foothold in our society in terms of being able to, for, you know, most people to accept or understand that there are explanations to things, yep, that we often, for in the past, considered to be miraculous and magical and so forth. But no, there's actually a scientific explanation as to why this, you know, the whatever, an eclipse or, you know, what have you. But, and I'm sure I'm not going to make any, well, I guess I won't, ostracize anyone on your show, but
I don't make a lot of friends sometimes too, Ken.
Yeah, but I mean, what percentage of the world would you know, Christopher? You know, worldwide, how many people? What percentage of the population of the world is still pretty religious or spiritual?
Oh,
would you say it's 90%?
I'd say close to 85 to 90%.
I mean,
worldwide.
It's way up there.
And,
you know,
and
if
that's
you look
beyond
at all the major religions around the world, you know, you certainly have most people are still pretty religious and spiritual.
That's right.
And it's up to the individual in terms of deciding how science or if science can be incorporated into their reality, you know, and coexist with their religion or their beliefs.
Well,
so.
and you know, that is quite literally one of the, and this is why I love having the two of y'all together, because frequently we are having adjunct conversations whenever I have both of you on, and that is that connection, that weirding connection between science and the paranormal. And I will bring up an image that I bring up in every single one of my talks to preface this, because you just brought it up, Ken, and that's quantum entanglement. This is actively at the image. This isn't like a representation of people. The image that I have up right now is basically a yin yang for you listeners out there who aren't on video. It isn't like, hey, squint and lean to the left and it's a yin yang. Mm-hmm. Like, it is precisely a yin yang. And this isn't like the graphic representation of two entangled photons. This is an actual electro scanned image from the microscope of two entangled photons. This is what cultures have been in religions older than Christianity have been talking about for millennia. So the day that that picture won the Nobel Peace Prize for science and for physics, the whole conversation changed. The whole conversation changed. Suddenly, you had quantum physicists and the whole idea of you know, a holographic reality being so much more the conversation. The idea of strange powers like psi, remote viewing, that kind of stuff. The lab work into that suddenly took a spotlight. Because, yeah, we find out that ninth grade science concept of us all being 90% empty space and even being entangled with a Sasquatch right now. Beyond seeing one, people, you are entangled with a Sasquatch right now. All right?
Here it is.
Like, it goes deeper. It goes deeper. You know?
Oh, that's awesome.
So, like, that's the actual science of it. So it's really wild to think about. Once again, where this discussion should even stop? Should it stop? Because once again, we know that these connections are out there. We know that things are entangled in strange ways. We know that there are species discovered every year, literally on the order of thousands of them. Most of them insects and bugs, deep sea creatures, all kinds of things like that. But thousands every year. Remnant animals found. So the idea of a Sasquatch being out there, you know, I'm one of those that's like, feel free to find me a full skeleton of a bear out in the woods. I'll wait.
Yeah.
You know, feel free to find me a full carcass of a deer. Even then, you rarely find that. You find bits and pieces, something like that. So scientifically, let's start switching this conversation now. As far as these topics go, Ken, what do you think? Because we've had the conversation on the show before. I think it will take a whole lot more than a picture. I think it's going to take a whole lot more than a video. But what we do get whenever, and I'll bring up the example of the rare ocelot in, I believe it was the Philippines, all in the last year that they have gotten video of. From video traps, things like that they have thought was extinct for generations, that they have found is back. And it's through that kind of technology, it's through this kind of work, that they weren't even searching for that. They were doing work on other things and came across that. But what that does is allow now for good science to happen on something that people thought was extinct. I'm sure there was more than one researcher who was like, we should be looking for these because people are still saying that they're out there. And if they're out there, they're more than endangered and we need to take care of them. You know, same thing with the thylacine, stuff like that. So, what do you think?
That's a good example of where there'd be perhaps a delineation between, you know, different aspects of, you know, the unexplained that we investigate. So in my field, yes, in order, you know, when we say for them to accept it, you know, we're basically talking about the scientific establishment, right? Because we would want, for example, Sasquatch to be identified as a species and classified and accepted, and then it's in textbooks and things.
Yeah.
So, you know, we do require empirical, science requires empirical evidence for that. So no amount of physical trace evidence like footprints or films, eyewitness testimony, it doesn't matter how great a circumstantial case you can put together for the existence of something like Sasquatch, but ultimately zoology and anthropology and all the fields that would make that decision, they would need something physical. So even a tooth or a DNA, which is where I think it's actually headed. I think that's going to be the most sensible way to prove it. DNA, a tooth, a body, a bone. But, you know, regarding other aspects of the paranormal, things like psychic phenomenon and, you know, extraterrestrials and things like that. Well, I guess extraterrestrials, you could also potentially have some kind of physical evidence. But, you know, well, let's talk about the parapsychology and like kind of the thing that Anne's writing about in her new book, which, you know, what is it going to take to prove something like that to science? Because you're certainly dealing with more of a, right? I mean, am I kind of onto a...
Yeah, well,
an idea here, or
remember the morning of the parapsychon, and I was like, oh, because I was wondering about the microbiology and wondering about the, you know, projection of like synchronicities and all that kind of stuff. And if we could somehow figure out how it looks on a micro level to see how far it can go out, you know, like.
Micro as opposed to macro, you know, breaking things down to either the cellular or molecular level. But yes, I mean, I know that universities have had, you know, parapsychology. Yeah, this was probably more in the 70s. I don't know how much. And you guys have talked about remote viewing and government programs that actually tried to explore some of these. But in terms of, you know, proving it, and that's another thing I've noticed about many of our friends in the ghost hunting field. There are some researchers out there that are trying to collect audio recordings and get film of phenomenon, stuff like that. But it seems like a lot of people in the paranormal field, the ghost hunting field, seem to be in it more for kind of the experience and the personal validation or the connection to the spirit world.
Sure.
And kind of, you know, forming a bridge between the spiritual world and the physical world. But many of our friends tell us, you know, they go on these expedition investigations and it's like something happened and it's like everybody experienced it and there's a kind of a shared experience. And,
well, and it's hard too, because we have no idea if we're actually the ones that are doing it and projecting it.
Yeah.
There's no way to tell what it is, but we automatically, or they automatically, project it outwards that it was a, whatever fits that moment, demon, child, you know, somebody's grandma, you know, whatever it is.
I literally have a rote phrase that I use on the show that I've used with both of you, that I use with numerous guests, that I use when I speak. And it goes like this. I believe that there is a large hominid being roaming the woods of North America and beyond known as Sasquatch. But I also believe that there is something else that is willing to use the tropes of our mind and our want of experience as a point of ingress to this dimension. That could be your CE5 experience of human initiated alien contact. That could be your experience at a Ouija board, or a seance, or your experience of asking questions to a spirit as you walk through a house. That could be your sitting up against a tree and going, please God, let tonight be the night that I see the big hairy one. You know, all of those are literally you opening the window for the vampire. The Now, the question comes to bear, is the experience the actual experience, or have you charged the environment? Which is why I say, like, if you're going out on a paranormal investigation, if you're going out somewhere that you regularly squatch and you think is an area of high activity, don't go digging rabbit holes. Don't go watching videos all night. Don't go letting it wrench. Get your rote checklist of gear ready. Get it ready. We got the gear. We got the map. We got gas in the car. We got snacks and water. Cool. Put it away and don't think about it till you leave, till you go, till you get there. Because the more you think about it, quantumly, the more you are affecting it. Hmm. You know, the more it's that whole idea of the more you think about, did I leave the iron on? Does it actually turn the iron on and burn your apartment down eventually because you thought about it so much, you know, that's kind of the point. And yeah, you know, even to hear you, Ken, scientifically say that, like, you may be adversely affecting the outcome of your experiment in that kind of way. I even put it to the fact of, at the very least, what you're doing by doing that is polishing the filter through which you're going to be looking at your data.
Absolutely. You know? I was just having a conversation with someone, a colleague of mine who investigates Bigfoot, much like I do, and in active areas, is constantly encountering these, you know, ghost lights and different light phenomenon and orbs and things like that. And it's a recurring thing. And I don't doubt he's documented it in film and different things. I've been investigating Sasquatch for decades in active areas all over North America. I've never seen an orb or a weird light or anything like that. So it's almost like he's somehow, or each of us are in a different reality of our research, you know, and I don't know if he's projecting that, but as you said, somehow stimulating or affecting the environment or inviting a type of energetic thing that, you know, basically allows that to happen in his, when he's out there. Sure. I'm just a wet blanket and all that stuff goes away. So.
Well, but you know, it's interesting that you bring that up because that's exactly the point, is that, you know, and it's, I think it's more the, I wouldn't say wet blanket. I wear my skeptic ass like friggin' Superman, dude. Like, it is always under my clothes, ready to go. but proudly so, because my job as a skeptic, your job as a scientist also, is to always be looking for the data that sways your decision. Always be looking for the data that changes your formed hypothesis or your tested hypothesis and makes you go, ooh, well, that's interesting, you know? Because I'm not there to poo-poo people's experiences or data that they've collected. I'm there to encourage people to, please, let's start looking at it dispassionately as data. Because that, when you bring it to a scientist finally, the day you finally do, the second you say, I have some evidence for you to look at, buddy, there's a whole different realm of questions that start. Like, immediately, because you've said, I have evidence. Mm-hmm. That's a totally different realm of questions to a scientist than, I have some anomalous data that I'd like you to look at.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If you come at them with anomalous data, the mind is open in a totally different way than, I have evidence. If you have evidence, my job is now to disprove your evidence.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, literally, that's my job as a scientist, is to challenge your evidence and make you prove your hypothesis now.
Yeah.
You know, so it's funky trying to get people to understand that and to dispassionately disconnect themselves from that experience that they've had, and to understand that even if what's found in their audio or their video or their photograph is quantifiable, that it doesn't remove the moment of experience in question.
Absolutely. Well stated.
Thank you. But what can people begin to do? Those that are out there right now, even those that are investigating to confirm their own belief, Ken. What can they do to gather good data? What can they do to begin going down that path of getting good data when they go out in the field that is usable by somebody?
Well, I'd like to, kind of go backwards.
Sure.
I think the most important thing that you just touched on is a system of peer review. So what I've found in my experience is that many researchers in this field or paranormal field tend to be very insular in terms of, it's their evidence, it's their data. And, they're reluctant oftentimes to let other people kind of objectively challenge it. And that doesn't happen in the paranormal field. People want to protect their evidence. It has a value to them. It kind of reaffirms why they're in the field or whatever, or that they're capable of collecting good evidence or good data.
Yeah.
But for example, I had a colleague who I really respect in the field of cryptozoology. He thought he had some good evidence of a Sasquatch, and he turned it over to a very respected researcher, but didn't give him any information or background at all. He just said, "Look at this," and basically there was no tendency to want to influence or plant a seed of idea of what, it was just, objectively, tell me what you think of this.
Yeah.
And just doing it like that is really, unfortunately, I think very lacking in our field. I think people are, even if someone's going to share some evidence with a colleague in the field, they're probably going to tell a backstory and why they think this is, so you're already kind of tainting the evidence and trying to win favor from a peer. So anyways, I know I kind of dodged your
question.
No,
you did not. You did not.
Peer review is really the lacking element, I think, in our field. And if we can't do it amongst ourselves, then certainly it's going to be much harder to go to the next level and to go to the academic community and try to present it to a legit PhD or scientist who's really going to challenge you in ways that your colleague in the field might not. So
and that's just it. There is that want of shared support in that kind of way, that want of confirmation of what you've spent good time in the field gathering. But yes, I firmly confer with you here in the fact that, and concur with you, that we need more independent data like that. We need more peer review, honest peer review. And that's the thing. Finding a ride or die, finding somebody whose opinion you value, who isn't just A, stroking your ego, or B, trying to give you the want of experience, the confirmation of experience in that kind of way. Someone that you're willing to allow to challenge your statements and beliefs is massively important. Massively, because most of it, and I understand, believe me, like I have a researcher who comes on my show who hadn't been on my show in almost 2 years, because she came on and probably about 6-7 months after, somebody started doing tours on her work. Zero credit given to the person that discovered this thing. Nothing. So it's hard because you do good, hard field research. You do that kind of deep digging library research. You would like to at least be notated by people when they go out and do tours and base a whole day of tour on your work. It'd be kind of cool. So I understand the want to be insular and the want to protect your squatching spot. I suppose the want to protect their identities because they don't like their pictures taken, Ken. but these, it can be hard with that data to allow somebody to have experience. Because it can be tough when somebody comes up when you've already red circled it. That is actively part of the problem. Because well, if that, go ahead, please.
If I may.
No, no.
I also think that it's something that should be done when people have their data and stuff like that, when, you know, whatever they've gathered, if they've already come to a conclusion, which most people sit there and go, oh, look what I found. I found this and this is what it is. I think that everybody that has done that, when they do that, they need to then ask themselves, why do I want it to be this?
Yeah.
Because when you ask yourself that, you know, why do I want it to be this? And then you start reflecting on yourself and then your biases and your background, you can kind of see patterns. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, at that point, you can kind of look at it a little bit more objectively if you can look at yourself that way and be like, okay, so maybe I'm projecting this on here. And, you know, and then lean into curiosity to be like, I want to see what somebody else thinks that doesn't have my background and my bias and everything like that. But again, I feel like it's wishful thinking. I don't know how many people are actually willing to do that in our field.
It's hard. It's hard.
Yeah.
And once again, it's hard to trust people to begin with. It's hard to trust people with experience, much less trust them with data. And once again, I think it begins with the researcher to begin to see things as nothing more than data. And it's literally the fact of once you start considering it as data, then you rapidly start considering things like, well, there's no way I could be picking something up every single night.
Yeah.
Like, I can be gathering a lot of data, but the fact that I'm gathering evidence every single night would be very, very slim in that kind of way. And the example I give is there was a gentleman in my UFO groups who used to post 3-4 times a week from right up around where you guys lived in San Antonio. Like, oh, there they are again. And it's like, dude, if you're posting videos the same time window, 3-4 times a week, I'm wondering why you're not selling tickets.
Yeah.
Why are we posting videos online? Why don't you have ticket sales at your front lawn? You know, why don't we have a food truck set up? Because if it's that dependable, the Marfa lights are weird. They're strange. They're still unexplained. There's an observation deck. Go hang out and watch them. You know?
Yeah.
So you have to wonder about those things. You have to be willing to question those things. I bipolarly, and in a good way, scientifically say, please more red circles. Because I think we as scientists, we as people examining things as data, need to be willing to court everything. That's just science. You've got to be willing to take it into the data set and call it out. But at the same token, the experiencer, the person bringing the data, has to be able to accept what the explanation is and understand the fact that they have bipartisanly done two things to science. You have now expanded the realm of known quantitative in investigating these things, whether it be a drone, whether it be a picture of a black bear from the side, what have you. We now have more known quantitatives and what they look like. So in theory, we're narrowing down we're whittling down every time we explain what's in a red circle and widening the scope of what the unexplained might be in hypothesis. Well,
I'll give you a couple of examples that are strangely related in terms of the origin of the data. But I had a researcher last year that sent me some photographs of weird footprints that no one could identify. And I pretty quickly figured out that they were alligator footprints, but they were near a body of water, but they were in a slightly unexpected place.
Sure.
Somewhere up north where you would think, oh, there's no alligators around here. But if you go back and do the research on that particular area, then you'll find out that every once in a while an alligator shows up in this area. It's weird. It shouldn't be here necessarily. It's not supposed to be here. But that particular researcher was not really wanting to hear
not
you know
hip
that
to
particular
it.
Explanation. It was
sure.
it, that's not what it, no, you know.
Yeah.
Anyways, that's fine.
No,
I got contacted from another group, actually a pretty well-known UFO research group that had a recording of a strange sound that was recorded while a UFO was being seen in the area near a lake. And this was, again, kind of somewhat up in the north. And I concluded that the sounds, which were very scary and deep and growling, were actually, again, an alligator. And I said, that's an, you know, an alligator grumbling there.
Yeah.
They're at a lake at night, and they're, you know, they did film something, but they thought, why are we hearing a weird growling sound? So, but they actually did accept, you know, they're like, wow, you know, we didn't know alligators could be around here. And I was like, yeah, actually, there is apparently like a wildlife, you know,
wildlife
park
refuge.
Or farm right down the road, and they had some alligators there. And so it was just two different responses for basically the same, you know. The second group, to their credit, were like, okay, that's weird. Well, we still have this UFO video, so we'll kind of focus on that.
And,
but the other researcher, you know, was just, you know, he had his shields up and he didn't want to accept.
Yeah. And so. I saw one in my group. I literally posted it. I took a screenshot and sent it to a meme group that me and my brother and buddy from high school belong to. Because the only thing I posted in the actual Bigfoot group was, it's Bigfoot's house now, you should move. and you may have seen the picture over the last couple few weeks, but it was a picture of like a 2-3 car garage door with scat all over the door. And then this person was like, a person in one of my research groups has been gifting for a long time on their property, this and that. And you know, this has been the result. And like the immediate thought is, you know, oh, I've been gifted back, you know, and that just blows my mind. I guess maybe as a kid who, you know, I'm not going to say I was a punk kid, but I definitely did a couple punkly things in my time, Ken, you know, and you were at one point a young 16-year-old male with nothing at all to do on a Friday night, guaranteed some poop landed somewhere it probably shouldn't have at some point during those outings, you know, like that's just what kids do. But the fact of, amongst a group of researchers, that instead of, well, did you contact the HOA? You know, like none of that. Immediately, it's, wow, that's incredible. You know, that is the first place that's gone to, is that you have been gifted back by Bigfoot. Like I said, my only response was,
strange,
it's
gift.
Clearly,
yeah.
It's Bigfoot's house now. You need to move. You know, like he's definitely marked his territory.
He's returning the used food.
That's it. Exactly. He did not like the bananas. But that's just it. And it's hard because there is good research being done out there. There is good work being done out there. Even amongst those communities, there are some people, I think, doing things at least somewhat properly in the way that they're doing it, Ken. And the problem comes to bear in all of this, whether it's psi community, UFO, paranormal, cryptid. How do we unmuddy waters, and how do we get once again science to be willing to accept an outreached arm of data, and how do we prepare our communities to prepare data and start looking at things as data? We'll start with you, Anne.
Oh, me. Well, I mean, I think I'm getting to the point where I'm kind of going to beat a dead horse here. You know, it all, to me, it goes back to psychology. We have to really start looking at ourselves and why we're doing what we're doing, what we want to get out of what we're doing. Because if we have that self-realization in regards to, you know, are you in this because you want to better the community, because you're wanting to help heal people, you want to, you know, find answers, or are you doing it because you want the money and the fans and the authority or whatever? Nothing else, in my opinion, will get fixed or help or whatever without fixing that first. Psychology comes first, I think, in regards to all of that. Because then once we unmuddy the waters within our own selves, then we can come more clean into the community. And we're not, it's kind of like the whole, you know, when you get into a relationship and you have old wounds and they say you don't want to bleed old wounds on new people. Same thing with our community and the research that we do. So that's, I mean, that's my opinion on it. That's where it begins.
Okay.
Oh, that's great. I think in order to get the scientific community to look at, you know, or take any of this seriously, I think we just really need to get our act together collectively as a field and, you know, adapt more scientific methods like peer review, like, you know, heavy documentation and provenance of, you know, evidence and, you know, and just present it, you know, objectively instead of seemingly having some kind of desire or agenda behind it. It has to be presented in a very, you know, we're in their, basically, it's their home field, you know, we're the visiting team. So we want to go in there and present evidence and get, and there are scientists. I mean, we lost, of course, you know, sadly, Dr. Jeff Meldrum last September. Before him, there were guys in my field like, you know, PhDs like Dr. Grover Krantz and Huberman's before him. Currently, there's Darby Orcutt at North Carolina State who's doing Bigfoot DNA testing at the university. Dr. Haskell Hart, who we know down there, who's a, you know, a retired PhD. You know, it's about, you know, kind of bridging those connections with actual scientists. You know, and then, you know, they obviously know people, you know, so, but it's all about presenting it in their, in a language that they'll understand. And,
Exactly.
Hopefully we can get there.
Well, and that's just it. That's what I try and get across to the communities is that much like we, even within the communities, have to learn each other's nomenclature, you know? Whether you're talking scientific Bigfoot, woo Bigfoot, there's different nomenclature that both sides use. And if you want to have a conversation, you both have to be aware of that nomenclature and how to use it and when to use it. And it's no different than science. They are looking for, like I said, the difference between data and evidence to a scientist immediately changes the realm of questions that begin. You know, and where the conversation starts. So learning those things and even the fact of I've brought it up with you before, Ken, if you want to get into cryptozoology, if you're into Bigfoot, things like that, get into their environment, get into being a wildlife preservationist, get into find your local colleges, biology department, things like that are doing studies on wildlife, that kind of stuff. If you're out with five or six trail cams, give them the footage. Just bring it to them. Tell them what you're doing, but tell them, hey, I've got this area of property that I've got covered with eight or nine trail cams. I would love to bring you just the raw data. Things like that, because if they're out doing bear counts, deer counts, stuff like that, like you're now giving them good data that you can then later be like, hey, you know, amongst all that stuff I gave you, I ran into like a weird 20 seconds on this Thursday. Would you mind looking at that for me? And at that point, their attitude is totally different. You've been pumping them full of good data that they can use, that they don't have to get a grant to have five trail cams out in an area to count bears or deer or whatever. You know, so like you're saying, Ken, building those bridges, making those handshakes, really just like proper cryptozoology or even proper science, thinking outside of the box in that kind of way. And trying to break down those walls that both sides have built up equally, I think. So I want to thank
you, my friend.
Thank you. I want to thank you guys always for coming on, for being a part of the show. It's always a great conversation. It's even more fun having both of you on at the same time.
It's been an honor, truly.
Yes, thank you for having us.
Always
an honor, my friend.
Before we let you go, and let everybody know where they can go to find all your work, where they can go to find your new book.
Yeah,
and then Ken.
And Celine.com, a wonderful my website. You can find everything there. All my latest blog posts are there. All of my social media links are there. You can message me there, or you can message me on Facebook. I'm just under Anne Celine. And yeah.
Awesome. And
go ahead.
For me, my website is kengerhard.com, and you can certainly find links to my books on Amazon, and also my cryptozoology course. And also, if you go to Exploring Cryptozoology on Patreon, you'll have access to my critically acclaimed cryptozoology course, as well as my Patreon exclusive podcast, Cryptid Legacy, and other exclusive cryptozoology related content.
And I can attest, I went through the first series of courses. Absolutely phenomenal, well put together, Ken. I really think it's something that you should try and write it as a curriculum for elective biology classes. I think it would be hugely awesome to have out there in the actual world. So anyway, thanks so much, guys. I truly appreciate it, as always. I'll be in touch with links, all that kind of good stuff. You guys take care.
Awesome. Thank you. Good night.
Thanks, everyone, for listening in. All right.
Man, always a great conversation with both of those guys. And we as investigators, we as people who, A, are into these topics, have to take these things into consideration. We have to take the curation of our communities into consideration. That is something that I have advocated since the beginning of this program, is that there are numerous people out there in all of these communities, even in the events world in these communities, that, as Anne said, horribly and parasitically come into these communities, use the belief systems, use the things going on and the topics going on inside of them as a means of not only division within the communities, but also as a means to profit from them and their belief systems, things like that. So when we come back from this commercial break, we will be joined by our good friend Mike Turber. We will be talking about the pursued documents, the second tranche of files that has been released by the U.S. government, the videos, the photos, the documents themselves, what they mean, what they're about, and what this disclosure moment truly means. We'll be getting into that with our good friend Mike Turber from 5x5 News right after this.
The key to good science is good research. At the heart of good research is a good data set. With the field observation and encounter log from Curious Research, you can easily keep track of your investigative information all in one place, making it easier to review cases and readily see comparisons and contrasts between them. Whether out in the woods squatching, in a back room gathering EVPs, or using high-tech gear to track UFO UAP activity, this easy-to-carry, pocket-sized scientific data log is the perfect companion for any field researcher. You can find your copy of the Curious Research Field Observation and Encounter Log at Amazon.com or visit the official Curious Realm store at CuriousRealm.com/store to reserve your copy for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is CuriousRealm.com/store.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome back from that quick commercial break. Thank you so much for staying with us. Also, thank you so much to our sponsors, especially True Hemp Science. If you're a user of CBD products like I am, stop on by TrueHempScience.com today. Christopher Lynch and True Hemp Science use a spigeric process where every part of the hemp plant is used. Every part. That's seeds, stems, buds, roots, leaves, Every part is used, combusted, and reused, and that process followed time and time again until nothing remains but an amazing Spigeric product, complete with terpene profiles and all. Stop on by, check them out. Their website is truehemscience.com. The code that you want to use is CURIOUS7. That will get you 7% off your entire cart of $50 or more, as well as free edibles on your way out the door. I have been using True Hemp Science for years for my travel anxiety, and I am here to tell you, folks, it is absolutely amazing. The terpene profiles alone are phenomenal. I have never found other CBD products on the market. It's normally just like glycerin and general CBD oil. These guys are absolutely awesome. Stop on by, check them out. TrueHempScience.com is the website that you want to go to. CURIOUS7, again, is the code that you want to use to save 7% and get free edibles on the way out the door. Our guest in this segment is our amazing friend, Michael Turber. He is the founder of 5x5 News. We will be talking tonight about the Pursue files. There has been the second series of files dumped, folks. Feel free to stop on by curiousresearch.org/research/Pursue. And I have made a nice easy document there that has hyperlinks that go to all of the videos, all of the photos, things like that. That is a downloadable document. There is a description of the video there, what the video name is, where it was taken, the date, all that kind of stuff. And there is just a massive, I would love to say massive trove of documents, Mike Turber. I would love to say that there is a massive trove of videos and photos that's been put out. Curious Realm has more documents.
Of course.
The Black Vault has, like, good God, you want to talk about trove? You know, so welcome back to the show, brother. Welcome back.
I appreciate that. Thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure to be on your show, and I just absolutely enjoy every time I do it.
Same here. And, you know, once again, it's one of those, we were talking pre-record. Mm-hmm. And like I've been saying on most of the shows I have guested on, like I have been saying on this show since the first government panel that we had, you and I had Earl Grey on to talk about, that these things are not for us. These panels going on, folks, are not for us. These disclosure files going on that have been released, you can go to war.gov/UFO to find all of the photos, videos, documents, things like that. These things are not for us. They are not for the UFO UAP community in that kind of way. But most of these things, I want to say out of the 9 that were just released in this second tranche of files, out of 9, like 5 of them were in Jeremy Corbell's documentary that just released, Sleeping Dog, before they were declassified and added to this, you know?
So that leads to a lot of questions.
Well, it's also the fact of, once again, a lot of these videos have been out in the communities already. They've been out there and in people's hands and in researchers' hands and, you know,
communities. So it's real safe for them to let these out. They've already seen the effects of what might happen. So, you know, it's kind of like, keep in mind when the Tic Tac Gimbal and Go Fast video came out, it took a while for the Pentagon to even acknowledge that those videos were real.
Yep.
So this is kind of that all over again. It's, you know, you've got the videos that Corbell gets his hands on or people bring to Corbell. Then in some ways the government's somewhat possibly obligated to go ahead and release them because they're already out there. You might as well, you know, what difference does it make anymore?
Yeah.
That kind of thing. But there's a lot of other questions that come along with it. But you know, it's very similar to what happened kind of before different happenstance, you know, as far as the people and the outcome, but similar process nonetheless, even as a different agency and stuff. But yeah, it's interesting.
Well, and you know, once again, it's the idea of these videos, these files, these photos that are, and even audio clips that are being released, mm-hmm. Are for the people who question why the government is looking into it. They're right. They're for the people who question why the government is spending hundreds of thousands and millions of dollars to right. look they, into I mean, this they, topic.
And yeah, they have to justify all that.
Well, yeah. And what this does is show the fact of, oh no, we've spent billions, and over the last like 50 something years, 60 years, and well, we're doing that for good reason.
Yeah. You know? And some of that reason, we hope that at some point in time, a true, actual, bona fide, non-nothing burger disclosure actually happens, and we get something for our money, you know, so to speak. You know, right now, I think everybody, you know, we get all excited when we hear that there's going to be a release, and I think sometimes there's a certain select group of people that tend to overhype the release that's coming. And then, you know, it comes out and, you know, people get disappointed in that. But we still get to see new information that we didn't have before. And anytime that happens, that's a good thing. And in this case, you know, we get to see a little bit more. It's, you know, there's no real earth shattering video or anything that no. really jumps out, except for a couple where, you know, people are explaining what we're seeing, but when you put the math to it, it's kind of like go fast. It's not exactly as we were originally told, or it's something that's a lot more prosaic, and it's frustrating because everybody wants the information that comes out to be, you know, something extraterrestrial or something, you know, yeah. you know, interterrestrial or all of the above, but at the same time, we want it to be true. We want it to be truthful. We don't want a bunch of fluff thrown out there. And I think in some cases, some people are considering some of this fluff. Some people are considering it and a step in the right direction. At least we're getting something. We're getting more people turning heads, looking into the subject. And the more heads that look at this, the more eyes that are on this, the more information that we should be able to get out, either yeah. internally or externally.
Oh, no, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, it's kind of like whenever we had you on to talk about the drone flaps mm-hmm. that were going on, mm-hmm. Mike, and people are like, yeah. oh, my God, there's so many drones. And it's like, oh, my God, it's the exact same number of drones.
Yeah, it's just there's, more people are looking up.
You're looking up and now you're looking for drones
yeah,
is,
exactly.
is what it is.
Yeah, and they're you know? Seeing regular aircraft. So,
you know, and it's one of those like, oh my God, there's so many more sightings. It's like, in average, there's just about the same number of sightings mm-hmm. as there have been every year.
And you would think naturally, as time progresses and more people get their hands on drones and various other types of, you know, consumer and even military aircraft, that we would see. An uptick based on the population, the number of cameras, the number of phones, and so forth, and you would see that. But it's honestly been holding at about the same percentage. It's just we are now we have a very good group of guys who are able to push some of this stuff out to the mainstream media that's getting yeah. some eyes on it. You know, we may have some differences here and there about how they do it or some of the,
yeah.
you know, material that they choose to use. But at the same time, it does put more eyes on the subject, which is never a bad thing.
Yeah. And I have said that about, and I just had the opportunity, sadly, to go see Lou Elizondo in Dallas, and my wife, I love her. I had completely forgotten that I had purchased tickets to go see Jerry Seinfeld with her for Christmas.
You had to choose.
And like my buddy Daniel Allen Jones texted me. He was like, "Hey, you know, I've been asked to help promote the Lou Elizondo event in Dallas, you know, for his mm-hmm. for his new book. Would you like to come?" You know, and I was like, "Heck yeah!" Like, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And I went to go put it on the calendar, man. And I was like, my God, I'm a horrible husband.
Like, you bad, bad boy.
You remember that ticket you bought for your wife for Christmas to go see Jerry Seinfeld?
Oh, boy.
I had to call up and tell my buddy, like, dude, I'm so sorry. And as a newly engaged man, I was like, caveat, be careful, pay attention to such things. Try to remember what you purchased tickets for with your loved one, you know.
Oh, yeah. You gotta do that. You gotta take care of the family first.
But in all reality, it was mm-hmm. one of those, I wanted to go see Lou. I wanted to, you know, invite him on the show. He's invited. Numerous people are invited, mm-hmm. Mike. And I'd have questions. I'd have some real mm-hmm. questions. But all in all, it's the fact of without people like him, without people yeah. like Jeremy Corbell, without people yeah. as much as I hate to say it, like To the Stars Academy and stuff yeah. like that, we would not be having a lot of the conversations that we are having now.
That is very true. That is very true. And this year, as it progresses, the very thing that Lou Elizondo and TTSA brought to the playing ground, so to speak, was those three videos.
Yeah.
That they took, the Gimbal and Go Fast. And those three videos are pretty much what's kicked off this current wave of UFO conversation, and we would not be having this if it wasn't for that December 16th, 2017, a date that will live in infamy.
That's right.
That this all got laid out. New York Times put out the information. To the Stars Academy was essentially born, and we had a crew of people that were on board, you know, from Chris Mellon to Lou Elizondo and Simonin, and all the way down the list. Yeah. Of some very high profile people that were on board.
Hal Putoff, all kinds of good folks.
Hal Putoff, and of course, Ramp, you know, the thing was run by Tom DeLonge, who's the, you know, lead singer to Blink 182. And very soon after that, the conversation started. And, you know, I had, you know, my conversations, you know, with Tom DeLonge and Lou and so forth. And, you know, everybody's got that moment that they, you know, that they decided to, you know, look at these objects and go, wow, that's got me thinking something totally different, because it's a yeah. different way that it was presented. It was in the New York Times. It wasn't in the Enquirer this time.
Yep. Yeah.
It was not some obscure, you know, middle of Montana, you know, TV station doing this. This is the New York Times, and it just, yeah. it doesn't really get more reputable than that. And the rest is history. We were having this conversation. Otherwise, we would not be having this conversation if that never occurred.
Yeah, absolutely, man. And quite literally, when you're talking about the articles by people like Leslie Keene that really kicked mm-hmm. all this off, black budget, black money, or black money, black projects, and dark skies or something like that. I can't remember what the title was, but it was Leslie Keene and her writing partner and Lou Elizondo right. that really brought yeah. that to the table. And even whenever you consider some of the things that have happened since then, Mike, from yeah. from that article to the article that came out where the community was all a kerfuffle, because, you know, it came out that the CIA and other alphabet agencies have used stories from within the community as cover for their black budget projects for absolutely, years and yeah. years. Because, yeah. hey, why have a PSYOP officer when there's a whole group of believers out there writing the PSYOP for you? You know?
Yeah, exactly.
Like,
yeah.
Why even employ one?
Yeah, it's not necessary. They saved a ton of money. And basically, yeah. we are various people were doing the job for them, and a much better job probably than they could have done themselves, because, you know, yeah. let's just face it, they're probably not going to dabble into this area for any length of time.
Well,
and that's a good thing.
Thankfully, thanks to things like InQtel and programs like yeah. Prism and the arms into platforms like, you know, Facebook and InQtel, giving money to the first round of that, NQTEL giving you the money to the first round of Twitter, all kinds of things.
Right.
These technologies that we're actively using to share these stories are just funneling straight into them.
Yeah. I mean, Wi-Fi, Bluetooth and all of these technologies were basically invented. The internet itself was invented because of ARPANET. In the beginning, you had ARPANET and what have you. And it was a military / university thing. And here we are. But the bigger part of the picture, I guess, is that as this conversation moves forward, as we start talking about these things, we start to see a certain pattern develop. And, me, because of my previous employer, those patterns that develop sometimes go the right direction, sometimes go the wrong direction. And sometimes we have to do a course correction. It's just like, you send a satellite or a probe to a planet, and you've got to course correct as it goes along. Yeah. If you start deviating, and that, I think what we're having now and what's going to, because you can see in the arguments that go on Twitter or X and various other platforms, that this is a very contentious subject when it comes down to it, as far as, certain aspects of the videos. We're being told certain things that the videos are and so forth. Yep. And then you have, the one side of the fence versus the other side of the fence. And that's the area that I end up being thrown into quite often. And it's an area I truly enjoy, because I do like helping people. I do like identifying what things are and what have you, and moving things right along. So, we can get to the meat of the matter. 'Cause, if they're here and, we've got people testifying in Congress, they're swearing under oath. We've got this stuff going into the national record. And at some point in time, if all of the things that we are being told through the hearings or what have you are true, then our government truly does have a lot of explaining to do. But then in the other end of the spectrum, you also have a large group of people who say that this open door into government is bringing in a lot of people that may or may not have direct information and what have you, and they're feeding into it. And that feeding frenzy might be stirring up a whole hornet's nest that might come out here at some point in time.
Yeah.
But either way, in the interim, we know what's going on. We know there's something going on that we don't know, that the government does know, and that we want to know, and we want that information to be revealed and everything declassified. And when they do it, we want everything. We don't want, like you were saying earlier before we came on, about all the redactions and various other things that prevent us from truly knowing what we're looking at. If we got a blob on the screen, that's great, but we need all the other data that comes along with it so we can help figure out what these things are.
Yeah. Yeah, no, precisely. And I've got the first image from this second dump on screen right now, where you can see that it's an image where all of the data on the side of the image that's taken with the forward-looking infrared camera on, whether it's a gun pod or on a airplane, or whether it's a forward-looking infrared on a Reaper, what have you. All the data that you would be looking at that shows elevation, distance to object, speed of the object, speed of the platform tracking the object.
And what's odd about this, especially this particular image, is we have this video with the data shown on the video. So why they didn't do it in the release doesn't make a whole lot of sense, because I use the data inside this particular video that you just showed to determine the object's distance, its speed, elevation, and things like that, and basically where exactly it was on the Earth, because it actually gives there's a grid system that the military uses that are 100-mile blocks. And they have numbers. I'm trying to remember off the top of my head the number on this. I think it was like C732 or something like that. And these blocks are gridded out over a map, so to speak. And they're 100 miles in length. And anywhere when you're in the map, it'll give you the your exact location based on where you are inside that 100-mile block. Like a little bit different than latitude and longitude, but you can transpose this even in Google Earth right into a map system. So that video there is, I believe, the Syria video, if I'm not mistaken. I could be, but I'm pretty sure that's the Syria video. And in that video, that object is moving, or the camera is aiming to the north. So that means the camera is south of that object. And it's an MQ-9 Reaper that's taking the imagery. And here we are looking at it at imagery that is not the original imagery, because the original imagery would be much sharper than this. And it appears, as I think on some of this imagery, that the image was taken by a camera aimed at a monitor getting that video. What's odd to me is if someone was taking a video of a video and then the government releases video and it's the same video,
yeah,
then that in and of itself is a problem. So the release that I've looked at has all the data on it. It shows me the location of the Reaper, gives me the location of, and now if you look at the crosshair on that image, that crosshair, when it's basically not on the object itself, it's a person trying to get more of a manual lock on this thing. And the crosshair will basically give you the distance to the ground behind the object. So a lot of people have seen the data, and the data that they're looking at, they're misunderstanding how it's represented on the screen. But the measurements, which we don't see here, would actually show the distance to the ground behind it. So the object is obviously in between the ground behind it and the Reaper. And as the Reaper moves, much like in the GoFast video, you have that parallax effect, and you're back to the same scenario that you had with GoFast, where the object's not really moving that fast. But yeah, in the video, when it moves in that northerly direction, there is a point where it darts off, or appears to dart off to the right. And that part of the video is the part that everyone pretty much looks at and questions what is actually happening there. There's a lot of debate about what is occurring in that video,
yeah,
especially over on X. And people have their opinions about things, and then you have your analysis of it. And after careful analysis, there's people that tell us that object is doing one of the five observables where it's showing instant acceleration. And I would argue that based on what I'm seeing, it's a very similar situation that we have with Tic Tac, where Tic Tac appeared to dart off to the left, but that happened to correspond exactly at the time of a zoom change. So we're looking at almost a similar scenario here, which creates that nothing burger atmosphere. But at the same time, some people don't hear this information. Some people are not getting the skeptic side of what we might be looking at. And they, everyone's feeding into it, which is natural. And yeah, over time, you gotta roll it back a little bit and say, hey, this is, remember that video a few years ago? This is what it actually was. But we keep moving forward, because that holy grail is out there and it will happen. And we're, I hope it's sooner than later, because I want to see it.
Well,
that we actually have that. Go ahead.
Yeah, for me, as you know well, Mike, it's data, 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 data rules the day. And whenever you get pictures, period, that have next to no data, like the one I've got up on screen now, the second still image that they put out, where it looks like kind of like 3.5 objects or something like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, to me, it more looks like something is submerged and there are three things on top of it.
It's hard to tell. And me looking at this image, the objects are not submerged, and the reason for it is the blurriness. I had this in you take what's called a Gaussian blur,
yeah,
and you kind of reverse the blur, so to speak, to sharpen it, and then you unsharpen it again, and then you put a mask on it, and then you feather it, and you do all these things you do in Photoshop. and then see what you have left at the end of the day. And if you compare, say, the wave crest in the background there, or some of the waves with the objects, you'll find that there's a quite a bit of difference. And if you look below one of them, it almost appears that you can see the shadow of it.
Yeah.
The bottom one, and then the one that's jutting out to the front there a little bit. But then you don't see it on the top one. So it kind of makes you wonder, okay, so we kind of see what may be a shadow under the second one. And then that leads me to believe that it's probably not a shadow. It's just like the object in front and a little bit below that appearing shadow. It's just another dark patch on the thing. So these are the things we look at, and we don't really rule anything out. We just lower the chances that it's a shadow, or lower the chances that it's above the water or below the water, or, you know, go back and forth. It's a percentage thing.
Well,
and at the end of the day, you hopefully have an answer of what it is, because most people ask them, what are these things? Not necessarily, is it real or not? It's real because we're looking at it and the military says it's real. So now we need to determine, okay, what is it? Is it?
Yeah, they at least say it's something. Mm-hmm. And that there's something there. Whether or not all these things are that thing, we don't know. And they're perfectly willing to say that. And that's just it, is the fact of, are these files like capital D disclosure? Absolutely not. In a 1,000%, they are not. There is no alphabet agency standing up and saying, yes, we host the black funded program. There's none of that. That's disclosure. Okay. Yeah. This is the hangar at Wright Pat where you can go see wreckage. That's disclosure.
Yeah. Right. And I think when that happens, that will be such a huge news story that we will all definitively know that disclosure has occurred.
Yes.
And, yes. Yeah. And this may be like what we've talked about in previous episodes, where we talked about some form of soft disclosure. Is that what we're getting? That are we getting prepped? Are people trying to see how various organizations or countries or different sects of people or whatever, how people react to these things? And I think, I don't know about you, but as far as I'm concerned, yeah, I can say without any doubt that I think everyone is ready to know the answer. We don't need someone else holding that information back. And I guess with Trump in there, I think it might be interesting to see exactly how far he pushes this to get us the answers that we're looking for. So my fingers are crossed, definitely.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, Mike, because, once again, these things are about conversation. That's what it's about. Mm-hmm. It's about opening conversation, starting conversation. We do not have to have the answer of anything regarding this topic. Not whatsoever. Not even as researchers, investigators, anything like that. We do not have to have the answer.
Right.
We never have to have the answer. What we have to have is a willingness to have the conversation around the questions
that
what is presented brings up. And that's whether you're talking about the very clear line that has happened of incidents involving the U.S. government, everything from the beginning of this to the founding of Arrow, to it coming out that no, Arrow was basically a front to to the, we're going to disclose everything. We're going to make a website. We're going to put everything out there. And really all they've done is basically a very light version of the work that Glenn Greenwald has already done over at Black Vault. And then on top of that, go out and register aliens.gov and start that whole kerfuffle and there it is, folks. There's aliens.gov. It takes you to whitehouse.gov/aliens. And it's basically a website about exactly what I said it would be about on social media. No. What they're doing is using one thing to hype their rhetoric about illegal aliens. So that's what the aliens.gov website is. It's all about illegal aliens walking among us and what to do with them. But it's interesting how they are paralleling the two of those and how they purchased aliens.gov right on the heels of saying we're going to release this information, everything else to literally garner interest toward the other.
That kind of takes some of that seriousness out of it a little bit.
Sure.
You know, we all know what we wanted to see when we went there, and then to have
I know what everybody wanted to see, but at the same token, like, I fully called the fact of that is not what they purchased that for.
No, exactly. That was funny. And the timing, of course, is
but at the very same, suspect. At the same token, it's one of those... it does spur the conversation. It does move the conversation forward in a different way. And that's what I think all of this does. I think that's what all of it is more for, because, of course, no sitting president is going to be able to even sign a presidential declaration or order saying declassify this, disclose it.
Yeah, and keep in mind, there's several things. As you go from one president to another, there's many things that the next president won't know that happened during the previous presidency, because it's a need-to-know basis. And I kind of like how that system works. Seeing it in action, you know, when you're in and you benefit from it, you know, on that need-to-know basis, it's kind of like, okay, well, we need him to do this, and so he's now in this program, and he kind of speeds things along. But the bigger question is, the president has the ability to declassify anything at any time. I believe in this instance, if Trump would have been presented with something that was so definitive, that he would already have a working knowledge of it, and he would have probably already, you know, released something to that effect, or definitely alluded to it. And some things he says, he's just playing with us, where he does kind of allude to something, but nothing in particular, because he walks everything back the next day, and he gets frustrated. Yeah. But you know, Clinton and even Obama, I mean, they have made statements that you know, that lead us to believe that there's something going on. There's something that we need to know. And then you have statements by high, you know, very high placed officials that are telling us that, you know, non-human intelligent beings are, you know, among us. They're telling us the types of species there are and various things like that. And, you know, I have to sit back and kind of go, well, I'll wait on that one a little bit till I get more evidence to support it. I will certainly look at anything that comes our direction, but I don't have anything that I can, you know, honestly tell you or your viewers here that I can say with 100% no doubt that we have them living among us. I don't have that information. I wish I did.
Yeah.
But
same here.
Looking at some of the stuff. Yeah. And there's something, and the stuff that's been presented to Congress, you know, you got Jeremy Corbell's, anything that he's attached to, sometimes I have to kind of, you know, take it with a grain of salt, because we've been hyped up so much in the past, and almost each situation has been somewhat of a disappointment. But now the stakes are much bigger. These people are now testifying in front of Congress. This stuff is going into, you know, the national record. Is, you know, all of these different things that are happening are, you know, if these people are lying to us, what will be the repercussions to that? Or if they're not lying to us, but what they're being told or what they're being shown is something that is messing with their minds, what does that tell us? We already have, you know, Havana Syndrome. We have various other things where we believe our government or other governments are doing things messing with our minds. And is this yet? And have they found another way to do it to mess with us?
Well, yeah, they found that long ago, man. I was on Into the Paranormal.
Mm-hmm.
All of a couple weeks ago while I was at work in Vegas, and talking about MK Ultra stuff like that, and how we now have means at our disposal to do these things without pricking somebody with a needle. Without putting drop one in their water, We don't need those physical means anymore. And don't get me wrong, folks. I understand the want to get into 5G and 6G and all that kind of stuff. And nanotechnology when it comes to targeted individuals. Stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Absolutely unnecessary. Never been necessary to target people with anything on a nano scale.
Right.
0%. Yeah, the body is much more susceptible to things and just general waves and things like that around it.
Right. And that was another thing, too. And, you know, when you think about this, just as a prime example of what you're talking about, think of something like chemtrails. So you have an aerosol gas that's being sprayed through our skies that's going to basically infect everyone, including the people that are doing the spraying and their families. So why would they do that when it would be much simpler to literally just go down and do something with the water supply, or B, you know, do something that is not, there's no contact, no anything. And that's where, you know, we're possibly looking at where several of the things, when it gets down to nanotechnology, these objects, you know, can enter into the body or the bloodstream or what have you with, you know, without any problem whatsoever. But what is the end game? What is the result? You know, what are we doing?
No, that's just it. At that point, you've subtracted the quote targeted part.
Right.
And you've just gone to blanket. You know, mm-hmm. and there's no vested interest in making everybody sick. There's right. no vested interest. Zero, even if it's to sell everybody a cure, everybody can't afford that cure. So there's no vested interest in such things. But what we know of MK Ultra, what we know of mind control, it doesn't right. take a lot to drive a society. It doesn't take a lot to push a society. The example I give regularly is what begat the Arab Spring in Egypt mm-hmm. with the overthrow of Hosni Mubarak. That was a right. Facebook post.
It was.
That was a Facebook post on a page that nobody ever really found the dude that said, hey, everybody, let's have a flash mob in the middle of downtown and take over the government. Mm-hmm. Like, we could kick Hosni Mubarak out if we all show up downtown. Like, you can't stop us all. It was literally like the equivalent of what they tried to do at Area 51 with the Naruto run. You know?
Exactly.
It was the exact same thing. It was like, let's all show up downtown and they can't stop us all.
That's right. That's
and next
right.
thing you know, one of the biggest dictators in the world was ousted. So it doesn't take much to drive and move a society. And when you have these means at your fingertip, once again, to even tap them to check the zeitgeist and pulse of a community and see right. where they're going and how things are, what percentage of them believe things in this right. You know, is right. this what we should use for our next
story? Some of the things are so, you know, almost subliminal to where, and it doesn't have to be like a major, like a regime change.
No.
It could just be a change in policy or a change in something that would benefit your own country. A slight change. We admit wholeheartedly that we are dabbling in the elections of other countries, but it seems weird that when the other countries dabble in our elections that we get all excited about it.
Hey, what's that about?
It's like, what? It's like, what's going on here? But at the same time, you know, you look at this from an aspect of, okay, we're not necessarily going to go in and do a regime change in this other country, but in Iran, but that's what they want to do. So they're going to do a bold move or what have you. But in Argentina, it was done totally different, but they used different technology as well. So once one was successful, one is still yet to be determined. You know, but at the same time, when you look at one being a precision strike to remove a specific entity that they knew that once they removed that, it was like removing a cancer, they could do whatever they wanted. And Iran is not the same scenario. So, there's a lot of complex things. So, you know, MK Ultra had a very specific and non-specific thing that it was trying to accomplish. And apparently there was enough accomplishments to where it has carried on into various other things, new technologies that otherwise would not even been thought of were created and utilized. And here we are today, with Havana syndrome as a very possible thing, and so forth.
Three prime examples from that is A, yes, there, since the church committee hearings and the findings of MK Ultra and Artichoke came out at the same time, as did Mockingbird, all these things, there is a law that prevents the government from testing on people. However, it's bypassable if it has to do with national security.
Yeah. Yeah. And national security seems to be the go-to answer.
There's that. There's also the fact of never, all capital letters, never, and you can check my math, people, feel free to confront me online about it. If you belong to the Alphabet Agency, you feel free to come at me and you let me know when it happened. But on record, never has the CIA told the truth to Congress when initially called to question, ever, about any black project. Things come out later, stuff like that. But when initially asked, never have they told the truth.
After prying, we find out. never have I seen anyone dance like that. Whenever a question is asked, in general, you're supposed to obfuscate or somehow, basically just push out an answer that either A, I don't know, but I'll get back with you on that, even though they do know, but they're never going to get back with you on that. B, when you're looking at the subject and you go, that's a very sensitive subject, it's a matter of national security, we can't discuss that, blah, blah, blah. So they always have these fallbacks, and it's just one after another after another. But when their back is against the wall and there's nothing else that they can do, and you're sitting there either in a skiff or even in a public setting where you are being asked by a senator, hey, did you do this, yes or no, and they still can't answer yes or no, then we lose confidence in the government at that point. And that's why we have these conversations. We're trying to get to the truth of everything, including this subject. So,
precisely, Mike. And the thing is, it's hard to get to the truth of something that has been purposefully obfuscated, that the research into by the government has been purposefully obfuscated. It's hard as hell to get to the bottom of something when a weird analogy but fairly apt is kind of like the medical efficacy of marijuana and THC. For nigh a century, almost since the 1920s, there has been an active campaign against marijuana. The fact that it's not medically used, classify it with heroin and, and ecstasy and things where there is zero medical benefit. Absolutely untrue. Total dialogue. Studies were buried. All kinds of things. To the point that when leaders of the former World Health Organization got studies, they were like, my God, how come nobody ever showed me these?
Right. Yeah. And then when you go back in time and you look at some of the advertising that was done for cigarettes back in the day.
Yeah.
Cigarettes were had some form of medicinal properties where it was, solved headaches and this and that and the other thing. And then move forward, you have marijuana that was basically frowned upon. And now it's completely flipped.
Yeah.
It's completely flipped. If you go out and ask people's opinion, what is your general opinion of marijuana or cigarettes? Which one has a negative impact? Cigarettes.
Well,
whereas 20 years ago, it would have been exactly the opposite.
Yeah.
But we know better now. We're educated now.
Well,
we know better.
Even looking at things, even looking at the dialogue and the conversation with all these things, the first document and the first tranche of files that was released by the government at the war.gov website. The first document that was released was a person who wrote to J. Edgar Hoover. And this person wrote to J. Edgar Hoover to let him know that I'm a researcher into the world of unknown aerial phenomena. I'm researching UFOs. I'm researching these strange things in our sky. And I belong to a group, to a national association that does the same thing. And we just had our Congress, you know, we talked about all kinds of scientific topics and here's what we talked about, all kinds of stuff. And I just want you to know, I love my country. I love everything about my country. And I am not, I don't want you to label me a communist because I'm researching this. Like that was, that was the first document released by our government. Was a document from a dude saying, like, please don't label me a communist or an enemy of the state because I'm looking into this.
Yeah, and there's no preface there. There's nothing that the government says, oh, we did this because we thought we should give you this subtle this subtle announcement that we believe this or we want to think this way or what have you. And so you sit back and you just read it for what it is, and everyone gets to make up their own opinion as to what they just read. And yeah, you're spot on that one. But, and that's cool.
But yeah, it's one of those like, no, this has been the dialogue the whole time. Is to demonize the people looking into it, to ridicule the people looking into it, to make the people looking into it seem like they're an enemy of the state, to discredit them, to do anything you can to sully their reputation or anything that they're involved in, so that any information they give about this topic is just ridiculous. Well, this is too much. This is crazy.
If you look at even something where I have something, you know, personally invested into it, John Greenwald at the Black Vault had put in
John,
a FOIA request.
I said Glenn earlier. John.
And he put in a request, a FOIA request, asking for information regarding the Tic Tac, Gimbal, and Go Fast and what have you, for DOD. Well, come to find out, Susan Goff, who was the spokesperson for DOD, had this was tracking the emails that was going back and forth between me, Eric Davis, Jack Sarfati. I mean, all of these people in there, and I think some of the and so that is 200 to some odd pages, and it's weird because it begins with my email and it ends with my email, but there's a whole bunch of other emails in the middle. And then he had done another FOIA request basically almost a year earlier where he was able to produce other emails, and here I am again. So I'm, you know, in these emails yet again. Even though they redacted them, it's quite easy to figure out who's who, because Eric Davis is yelling at me and I'm yelling at him, and we're going back and forth in these email exchanges. But when that email exchange came out, I had a lot of people, you know, question, you know, what was the gist of the argument? What was going on? And these are internal emails that the government was monitoring, and then John Greenwald was able to basically pull out, and they're there for, I mean, you ought to put them, I don't know if you have them on your thing, you might want to put them in there, because you know, I'm all over it, but
I sat longer back on that, and I think it's actually because the website that I had that had that email address is no longer. I'll have to give you a new email because I miss being a fly on the wall in that conversation. That was just a wild email thread to be a part of.
I never
contributed. But man, the conversations that would go on between
just
like major players.
Oh, yeah.
That was just like
arguing
what
back and
is
forth.
This? What is this?
I mean, you got Travis Taylor, you got
Brendan Fugel, all kinds of stuff. It was wild. It was wild.
Even Deepak Chopra's in there. I mean,
I'll text you my personal email. Best and add me back to that, because I miss just seeing the emails three or four times a week. that yeah. went through there.
Well, like, those emails are over on John Greenwald's site. They're on the Black Vault. So, they get into the minds of what's happening behind the scenes, and you get to see it unfiltered.
Yeah.
There, other than the redactions, but you get to see it basically unfiltered as to the conversations that we're having as to whether or not, you know, something should be on Gaia. You got the head of Gaia in there, asking me a question and asking Eric a question, Eric Davis a question, and going back and forth. And then, everyone jumps on board. And at the end, he has to make a decision as to whether or not he wants to do a certain way to take the show. And you see this and play out. And then you see the government has been monitoring these emails and seeing who's saying what and whatnot. And then it comes out down the road where everybody gets to see what was being said. And I think that's a good thing. That is kind of a disclosure that should be done anyway, because everyone should be responsible for their words, their actions, and what have you. But if it's a matter of national security, I fully understand sometimes you got to pull that veil back a little bit.
Yeah.
But other than that, I think we're ready. I know I am.
I know humanity's ready, things like that. Yeah. But I don't know if people are ready.
Yeah.
Mike, that's the thing. That's why they keep, it's why NASA had the 12 theologians. That's why good God, man, 1952 Brookings Report.
Right.
They talked about the religious implications and the societal implications and what would happen,
right.
And yeah, you still, at least with the religious implications, you really have to wonder. Yes, the Catholic Church came out in 2012, and or at least the Pope came out.
Right.
It wasn't an encyclical. It wasn't like an ex cathedra statement, or anything like that from the Pope. But the Pope came out and was like, hey, people keep asking me about aliens because it's 2012,
What's interesting is the Catholics.org website, which has their periodical and their news that they run, actually did an article where I was in the article. And, when I went to look at it, I was like, so they talked to me and then during the conversation, they said, you're the only person we've ever had in here that's a theist. And I said, you mean atheist? he goes, yeah. And I said, but y'all have written about other people that are that. Yeah, but we've never actually talked to them on the phone.
Yeah.
And did a conversation. And I said, that's a little different spin on things. And he says, yeah, you're the first one. So, yeah, on Catholics.org, we talked about Tic Tac and the possibility for alien life and whether or not that was in God's plan. And is it mentioned in the Bible and stuff? And there's a lot of things out there that go both ways for both sides.
Yeah, well, there's zero conflict with church teaching in the Big Green Book. There's zero conflict with the is it in God's master plan, or does it go against God's creation? Nothing. And that's what that's what the Pope said, was like, it doesn't go against church teaching. It doesn't reduce the miracle of Christ's life, death, and resurrection. It doesn't.
Right.
It doesn't remove anything from the seven pillars of faith. So,
right,
like if it only further proves the wonder of God's creation, and sounds like we have some other brothers to meet.
Yeah, and that's the question and answer that they brought into it, was that the claim is that it doesn't say anywhere that we were the only intelligent life created.
They
could have been created intelligent life on many things. I know I would do that. It would make more sense to do multiple to have the best chance of getting it right, everyone on both sides of the conversation can have that, and I think it's a unique position to be in.
And I am one of those, no longer a practicing Catholic in that kind of way. I don't go to church every Sunday. I don't go teach CCE or confirmation or RCIA or do retreats like I used to. I'm not a youth minister like I used to be, Mike, but I'm a former Catholic seminarian.
Yeah.
And I have numerous friends. Whenever I share things on Facebook, folks, just so y'all know, especially in private messages where like you get an invite to the show. Hey, it goes to 500 friends. It randomly chooses people. Sometimes some of those people are people that I used to teach with, Mike. Right. And they're like, why'd you share this with me? This is this is not what I'm about. You know, this isn't in line with my going to mass every day. And I'm like, that's what's funny, though, is that it is. Because if you're going to mass every day, you're starting every day the same way. And that same way is with the Nicene Creed. Even the modern version of the Nicene Creed goes through the seven pillars of faith. And the first pillar is I believe in God, the Father Almighty, creator of heaven and earth, of all things seen and unseen.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sure there's a lot more unseen in the universe than what our watery little globes and our brain can see, you know.
Exactly.
So if you're taking part in a Eucharistic miracle on the daily, I think we've already submitted to the unseen being a real thing.
Yeah, and I always tell people that either belief system that you belong to, whether you're atheist or whether you believe or it doesn't matter what the religion. If you go back and look at what each entity basically states the beginning of time and the beginning of the universe was, the descriptions are somewhat similar when you really think of it. When you reduce it down to something pretty simple, you know, from nothing, something was created in both instances. So there's always these arguments like the scientific community says, well, you created something from nothing. How does that happen? Well, the same thing happened on your side. There was nothing there. Then there was.
Yeah.
So it's the same thing. And if we could reach across the aisles and shake each other's hands and say, you know what? I never thought about it that way. You're right. Both sides believe that something came from nothing. And that's cool. And we can all move forward and, you know, sing along and have fun and
kumbaya on common ground. You know?
I was thinking that, but I didn't want you to say it.
but in all sincerity, Mike, it's one of those when it comes to disclosure, big D disclosure, when it comes to these files, the videos, the audio, the pictures, all of this stuff is for the casual observer. It's for the person that isn't ready for the conversation.
Yeah.
But has to be onboarded to the conversation in some kind of way. And if that means that the federal government is going to take the time to curate these files from different agencies and put them together in one location, the same way that John Greenwald has already done, same way I've already done, same way other people like, you know, Newfork and stuff like that have already done.
Right.
But if it takes the federal government taking the time to do it to make you go, oh, wait a minute. I didn't realize that they had been studying it to this capacity for that long. There's something else here. If that's what it takes for your ears to go dog sideways and for you to think and have a conversation, then good.
I think it's important that the government acknowledges that certain fields are being looked at and studied. I know that OSAP and ATIP, that one entity or two entities, depending on how you look at it, you did look into some rather controversial subject matter, but at the same time, it did cover the UFO base and UAP base, and that's where we're at now. And now that that's established, I think it's more important that, okay, we need to clarify that just because the government releases a video and says this is an unidentified flying object or this is, unidentified anomalous phenomena.
Yeah.
They both are still basically the same thing. We're not saying that something is, you know, if we admit that this video is real, a lot of people interpret that to say, oh, this video is real, then that means it's alien, and that means everything that goes along with it. And that's definitely not what they're saying. But there needs to be a little bit more scrutiny on some of these videos, because if our government can't identify some of these things, and within minutes of these videos coming out, I can identify it, or Mick West can identify it, or Metabunk or MUFON or various other, you know, people can look at this and go, wow, that's a this. Then that makes me question, you know, who are they hiring that can't, you know, pre-screen some of this stuff and determine what it is, or spend 15 minutes on it.
Or is it front, like we found out Arrow was? Don't get me wrong. I love our unified reporting system that finally exists.
Right, right.
And the fact that somebody can whistleblow and make a report without losing a career or their wings, Mike.
Right.
Arrow and Fitzpatrick were both plants.
Yeah.
You know? So the dialogue on that front absolutely continues. And once again, you're not going to find out the truth from the alphabet agencies. You will not. You will not. You will not. Not until you pin them down, put locking pliers on their teeth, and start pulling. At that point, you may find out some data. At that point, but unless you're choking them with a purse string, you will find out nothing.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. So, and even back in the days when I worked day to day in everything I see, you have to you would take some things with a grain of salt. But as you move through the mountain of information that's coming your direction, you don't have time sometimes to stop and go, wow, wait, what was that?
Yeah.
You know, you're looking at the bigger picture. If you're looking at data coming back or video coming back from a theater, from a Reaper, and it's telling you that this is a target zone, and you're the target acquisition officer, and you're trying to determine what place to be bombed, and some thing floats by in the video, you know, you're not going to take the time out to go, hey, what was that? But now you have a reporting method to say there was something anomalous in this video. We need to get this to the right department. And now they have a department.
That's right. That's right. And you can timestamp the video and have the system look at it and everything else. And you can move forward with the critical parts of your mission instead of rabbit holing on that. Because, well, once again, your job is not to rabbit hole on that. Your job is to use the observation platform to the tactical needs. Mike, thanks as always for coming on, for breaking this stuff down in such a simple way. When it comes to security, declassification, that kind of stuff. Before we let you go, let everybody know where they can go to like, follow, subscribe, where they can go to find all of the good work by 5x5 News.
Well, first, kudos on everything that you're doing there. Everything looks a little different tonight. What's
snazzy? Snazzy episode 235 action. This is the show look. We'll see. We'll
That's
see. Not
good.
That
looking
I don't
good.
Love the stars. The stars have been there since the very beginning. You know, like since the beginnings of Dudes and Beer doing video, we've had that star background going. So it's near and dear to my heart. It will always live. It will always exist. I'll always have it as a backup. But
awesome.
Yeah. Well, and who knows? I'll lightly fade these bricks and have the stars coming through the bricks. Who knows?
Oh, yeah. Just something very subtle, not like in your face. But maybe have a meteor go by every now and or something. But it's pretty cool. I like it. I like it. Dig it. Really nice.
Thank you, brother.
But as far as checking out some of the things I do right now, probably the best place to engage with me as far as looking at some of the more current stuff seems to be X. I'm working on building the studio out. I'm actually sitting in it right now. It's coming along nicely, and we should have that going into play here hopefully in the next week or two, which is a lot. Hopefully real soon that we can get back to some of the things that I like to do, because I've been kind of dormant here for too long. And so that's your best place. You can go look at some of the videos since our inception, or actually since YouTube deleted us and we came back. You can see all the way back to the Las Vegas investigation and so forth on YouTube under 5x5 News. So just search 5x5 News or my name, Mike Turber, and you'll find probably quite a few things, including a bunch of Curious Realm videos.
Absolutely,
that are out there. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. I always appreciate your time. I always appreciate your vast realm of knowledge with these things. And It's always great having you on, man. Hold the line real quick while we close things out for this segment.
Sounds good, brother.
Absolutely. While you are online, folks, checking out everything from Mike Turber over at 5x5 News on social media, as well as on YouTube. If you visit curiousrealm.com/videos, you can find all of the embedded video channels of our guests, including Mike Turber and 5x5, right there where it's nice and easy to find them, folks. Make sure to stop on by while you're checking out curiousrealm.com/video. Curiousresearch.org, that's where we were pulling these documents from tonight. Right there under the research tab, you can see Department of War Pursue UFO Files. These are downloadable PDFs that you can get that have hot links straight to all the video clips, all the pictures, stuff like that. So nice and easy to peruse your way through this stuff if that's specifically what you're looking for. And of course, links there to the war.gov/UFO/releases. So that's where you can find all of the data for tonight, folks. Thank you so much, as always, for your time. Thank you so much for your open hearts, your open minds. That is what makes the conversation. And without the conversation, humanity does not march forward. So remember, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and stay curious. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. To download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault, or become a sponsor of Curious Realm, visit our website at CuriousRealm.com. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast and video services, CuriousRealm.com, as well as KGRA Radio, APR TV, and the official Curious Realm app for Roku devices. Curious Realm is a proud member of the Ground Zero Media family of podcasts. For more shows and members-only content, visit groundzeroplus.com today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious. And remember, the other side is always watching.